the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brother and sister, Salamu alaikum and welcome to a new episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for choosing this program to listen to. And inshallah, this program would be beneficial for you. Today, we're going to speak about modern idolatry.
Yourself. Can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue, planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun, such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves. Isn't this proof enough for us?
On Tuesday, you'll listen to this program, 4th of Jamadi Uthani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 4th of the month of Azar, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 25th of November, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. As the ritual of this program, we open Allah's book, the Holy Quran, and we'll listen to chapter Al-Imran, verse 159.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Fabima rahmatin min Allah linta lahum. ولو كنت فظا غليظ القلب لانفضوا من حولك فاعف عنهم واستغفر لهم وشاورهم في الأمر فإذا عزمت فتوكل على الله إن الله يحب المتوكلين.
So by mercy from Allah, O Muhammad, you were lenient with them. And if you had been rude in speech and harsh in heart, they would have disbanded from about you. So pardon them and ask forgiveness for them and consult them in the matter. And when you have decided, then rely upon Allah. Indeed, Allah loves those who rely upon Him.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The content of the verse works as some general instructions, but the revelation of the verse is about the Battle of Uhud. The Muslims who had ran away in the Battle of Uhud and were defeated were burning in the fire of regret, remorse, and sorrow. They gathered around the Prophet and apologized. Then the Lord issued the command of their general pardon by this verse. Also, beside contemplation and consultation, do not forget to trust in Allah. Consultation and reliance in Allah are beloved with Him, whether we attain the aim or not.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light. You guides me through my darkest nights. Shows me right from wrong and right. That often lies, 'cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
In this episode of today's special, we'll look at the modern idolatry. The Quran engagement with idolatry is not preferable. It is the central drama of its prophetic narratives and the foundational basis of its theology. To understand its application now, one must first grasp the depth and nuance of its critique of the physical. The text presents physical idols as an epitome of spiritual and rational decay, a profound misunderstanding of both the nature of the divine and the status of humanity. The entire edifice of Islamic theology rests upon the principle of Tawheed, the absolute, indivisible, and uncompromising oneness of Allah. This is not a mere numerical assertion, but a comprehensive worldview that orders all of existence. The Quran's shortest chapter, Al-Kawthar, serves as its most conscious and powerful definition of Allah, a direct refutation of any form of polytheism or anthropomorphism.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Ali, your host. Today we are going to talk about modern idolatry in 2025. To learn more about how Feng Shui is promoted, we contacted training center. Some training centers were contacted offering courses. A young woman answered the phone, confirming it was a familiar contact, and explained that attendance cost actually is that much for 2 days, let's say. At another institute, the secretary refused to engage until assured of an acquaintance reference. When asked to explain Feng Shui, she pursued and replied, "It is a science about how to arrange home furnishings." She could not elaborate further when it was asked about the lecturer's qualifications. She quickly said, "The instructor holds a PhD in psychology, but is currently abroad." Despite this, Feng Shui courses are held in different areas. Some organizers claiming to have permits only register participants who are introduced by acquaintances. But what is about Feng Shui that fascinates people so much? What is behind the mass sale of symbols, the classes, and the online search results of Feng Shui? Have people found their lost paradise, or are they seeking a savior?
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special. This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
This is today's special, and we look at the ways of committing shirk. Fear others more than you fear Allah is one of the hidden ways of committing shirk. There is no one that we should fear more than we fear our Creator. So when a Muslim shows that they fear another human, maybe due to the fact the person could harm them, it is an act of disbelief. Yes, it's normal that there are people stronger or more powerful than us, and they can harm us. But our reliance lies with the one who is more powerful than any of his creation. And this reliance on the power of Allah should prevent us from fearing His creation such that we commit the act of shirk or disbelief.
Thank you.
to protect ourselves from shirk. A heart that constantly remembers Allah or do dhikr is protected from whispering of disbelief and doubts. Make it a habit to say the morning and evening dhikr, especially La ilaha illallah. That means there is no God but Allah alone. Also regularly make the prophetic dua. O Allah, I seek refuge in you from associating anything with you knowingly, and I seek your forgiveness for what I do unknowingly. This dua directly protects you from both conscious and hidden forms of shirk.
You have certain individuals that they disbelieve in Allah Azza wa Jal. They call themselves atheists, not because there is not enough proof for the existence of Allah. There are certain professors and scientists that they know there is a God, there is a creator, but they choose to disbelieve in God because of the arrogance that they have. I have to submit to an all-powerful being that tells me this is halal, this is haram, do this, do that. No way. Their arrogance, it prevents them from believing in Allah. Many of the atheists of this world, especially the intellectual atheists, the real reason why they're atheists is because of their arrogance. They don't want to submit to an all-powerful being that tells them do this and do that. Their arrogance prevents them from believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And you find that Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, he speaks about this. He says, halakun nasi fi thalath. He says, three qualities will destroy the human being. And one of those qualities that he mentions is arrogance. He says, فَالْكِبَرْ هَلَاكُ الدِّينِ. That because of arrogance, my faith may be destroyed. My religion may be destroyed and wasted. And then he says, وَمِنْهُ لُعِنَ Iblis. Iblis, shaitan. The devil, the shaitan, why was he cursed by Allah and he was kicked out of the heavens? It was because of his arrogance. Allah Azza wa Jal told him and the angels, do sujood to Adam. What did he say? The Quran mentions the story. He says, you created me from fire, and you created Adam from clay, from dust. And fire is better than clay. And I'll never do sujood to someone that is inferior to me. Allah told him, this is arrogance. There is no room for arrogance in Al-Jannah. And he kicked him out of Al-Jannah. So this was his weak spot. This all the mischief that exists in the evil that's from shaitan, it's the root cause was arrogance. All he had to do is one sujood to Adam. But he could not overcome that arrogance. And thus there is a beautiful hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam that says, مَا مِنْ عَمَلٍ أَشَدْ عَلَىٰ إِبْلِيسِ مِنَ السُّجُودِ. He says, if you really want to aggravate, if you really want to bother and upset the shaitan, do you know what's the best thing to do? Do sujood. Why? The Imam says, لِأَنَّهُ أُمِرَ فَعَصَى وَهَذَا أُمِرَ فَأَطَاعَ فَنَجَى. Because sujood is the weak spot of the shaitan. They say everyone has a weak spot. The weak spot of a shaitan is a sujood. That's his Achilles heel. Because this is where he failed the test.
Dear brother and sister, we open a new chapter here, and that was about modern idolatry, one of the great and important phenomena in modern life. I think it's better to continue this interesting topic on the next episodes of today's special from IRIB English Radio. So be with us, and till then, we leave you in Allah's mercy. Fi amanillah.
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي محمد نبي علي إمامي لا فتى إلا علي إمامي علي إمامي
علي إمامي.
لا إله إلا الله، الله ربي،
محمد نبي، علي إمامي.
لا فتى إلا علي، علي إمامي، علي إمامي، علي إمامي.
You can talk it down, turn the other way, fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody cares. It's an untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. Yeah, yeah. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear, but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. There's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me a hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear, but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. I need forgiving.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Dear listeners, have you ever thought about what holds a family, a friendship, or even a whole nation together? Is it all the fake ideas of too much of nationalism and so on? Is it money? Is it power? What is it? I think it is trust. Without trust, marriages break, businesses collapse, and societies fall into chaos. Friendships, every kind of relationship and connection collapses. So that's why the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, said, or is quoted to have said, he who has no trustworthiness has no faith. He who has no trustworthiness has no faith. And this is beautiful, that faith is interconnected with like the values that every human being can understand and agree, even those who have no faith. Trustworthiness, justice, and so on. They are the values that no one can deny, that they are values. They have to be observed and preserved. So Allah's religion is not apart from those values and actually backs them up. This short sentence carries a deep truth. Faith is not only about prayer, fasting, or rituals. It is also about character. And at the heart of character lies trustworthiness. Allah in the Quran praises those who are true believers, saying, "And those who are faithfully true to their trust and to their covenants, such are the inheritors who will inherit paradise." See? Notice how being trustworthy is placed side by side with the qualities of the people of Jannah, the paradise. Psychology today confirms what Islam taught 14 centuries ago. Studies show that when trust breaks down, whether in families, workplaces, or societies, it leads to chronic stress, anxiety, and even physical health issues like high blood pressure. Trust is literally a foundation of human well-being. Communities where trust levels are high have a stronger cooperation, better economies, and healthier individuals. Think about a simple example. If a doctor lies about a diagnosis, the patient's life may be destroyed. If a business partner betrays trust, a family's livelihood can collapse. If a leader cheats, an entire nation suffers. On the other hand, when someone is known to be trustworthy, people naturally feel safe around them. The Prophet himself was called Al-Amin, the trustworthy, even before his prophethood. His honesty built credibility that made people listen to him when he called them to Islam. So let us be good representatives of Islam and be trustworthy among people. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Ghazmi, and in this show we delve into the forces of war, imperialism and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. Today it's a privilege to be joined by Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is a British independent journalist and a long-standing campaigner for Palestinian liberation. She began her professional career as a graphic designer and illustrator before transitioning into the world of journalism, where she's become known as one of the few Western voices providing unfiltered coverage of the situation on the ground in Palestine. Because of that, Sarah has been targeted by the Israel lobby, and in August 2024, she became the latest British journalist to be targeted for arrest. Her house was raided by the police and she was arrested under the Terrorism Act. She had her devices seized and was denied vital medication while in custody. And since then, she's been living under strict bail conditions that effectively aim to gag her work. Although she was able to join the recent global Samud flotilla that aimed to break the blockade on Gaza before being arrested again upon her return to Britain. She currently awaits trial for terrorism charges that have been brought against her, which is scheduled to take place in January 2027. But despite the onslaught she faces, Sarah refuses to be silenced, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the show today. So Sarah, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Sarah, let's just start by looking at your story, because while you're a very important independent journalist now, in a previous life, you were doing something a bit different in graphic design and illustration. So how did you become a journalist, and what drew you to focus so deeply or more deeply on Palestine?
Oh, there's sort of two questions there. I mean, although I was a graphic designer, I was working with a newspaper, so which was pretty much pro-Palestinian. So my interest, if you like, in Palestine sort of like moved across, because it was already there. It was already there in the newspaper. So we ran a lot of pro-Palestinian stories in the early days. Some of them seem quite remote. I mean, we were covering the Ramallah tortoise, for instance, which not many people know about, the Palestinian indigenous tortoise that is being wiped out by the bulldozing of homes. So we were covering stories like that, water, conservation and things like that. But my interest in Palestine began years before that, when I discovered a leaflet in a library with a picture of a little boy facing into the barrel of an Israeli soldier's gun, and I couldn't understand it. I think he was about 10 years old. I think I was about 10 as well. So, you know, I took the leaflet, because this is the reference library. So I didn't take the leaflet with me, and I read it and I didn't fully understand it. So that led to me then trying to understand what was going on there. How could a child the same age of me have so much courage that he could stare into the gun of an Israeli soldier, and why? And so, you know, the research in those days was quite difficult. A lot of the books that were in the Central Library were all about tourism. They didn't explain the Nakba. A lot of it was from the Israeli narrative. So it wasn't until I really got to college and I was introduced to other pro-Palestinian people that it really began. I went to Greenham Common. That was one of my first protests. So I started learning about how protest works, why it's important, what happens when you get arrested, why people are being arrested. And it started to make the whole Palestinian issue make sense. So I was talking to people who knew more than me, who understood it from a political standpoint, which is, that was the thing that was missing in those days. So when you've done something for so long, when you've read about something for so long, it becomes intertwined in your, I suppose, in your blood. I'm not quite sure whether the Palestinians would want me to say that I have Palestinian blood, but it becomes entwined with you yourself. Everything that you do revolves around Palestine, and you grow up revolving around that research. And so then you start to meet people and have pen friends, because it was before the days of Facebook and before the days of Twitter, certainly. So the Palestinians that I was talking to, I was doing so by letter, and I was being introduced to more and more people, families with young children. And then Facebook came along, and suddenly I could actually see who these people were in real time. And I was able to talk to them. I was able to listen to their stories. So the connection was already there. And also, I will say, and I'll try not to make it sound horrible, but I also witnessed them being killed. So this is the first time, and it was many years ago, my pen friends hiding under their kitchen table were bombed, 2012, I think, and only the mother survived. Her six children were killed. And she talked about having to make the choice of whether she saved the baby or she saved her mother, because both were on the top floor of the building. And she saved her mother and was racked with this enormous guilt that, that the baby had died. And but then even her mother also didn't survive. So she was the only remaining person. So those were my original pen friends. So that was the beginning. That was the introduction to, I have to do something here. I cannot help this woman. I am geographically miles apart from her, but I have to do more than just read. I have to do more than just wave a flag and wear a t-shirt. I have to actually become more proactive. I have to save the next family. I have to do something. And also learning to live with the shock of losing my first pen friends, I suppose. They were my first loss. And from then on, I have lost many. It's never got easier, but they were my first greatest loss. And so there's always a place in your heart for people that are your friends. And then you want to find out why they died, what happened, what is needless, what can you do to solve the situation. So you become much more politically involved and you start protesting properly and you start understanding the story properly and you start reading about the politics properly. So yeah, it grew. It expanded, if you like, much the same as the Greater Israel Project. But yeah, that's how it was for me.
Well, I mean, the Palestinian cause has the capacity to awaken the moral consciences of people. I think what you outlined will certainly resonate with a lot of people. I mean, certainly for me, it was a case of, as you say, you sort of have this knowledge. Once you encounter the Palestinian question, you instinctively start to understand that this is an oppressive situation that should be overcome, that Palestinian liberation is something that's right and should be fought for. But then there's that gap between knowing something and then working out, well, what is your role in that process of liberation? But as we know, you know, walking on this path for the liberation of Palestine often comes at personal sacrifice. We know that the sacrifices that we endure here in the West are trivial compared to what Palestinians face. But in terms of, campaigning here in the West, you can face quite severe consequences, not death necessarily, but your case is a case in point. I mean, the strength of the animus against you from the Israel lobby is no doubt motivated by how effective you've been at reporting on Palestine. So let's just get into that. I mean, in August 2024, your house was raided, you were arrested and subjected to quite fierce repression. Now, walk us through what happened to you on that day and sort of the immediate period afterwards.
Yeah, it should be included actually before I start on that, you know, when we began campaigning for Palestine, we did not know that the repression or the oppression was this is how it was going to be. We didn't know that we were going to be targeted or that we would be arrested. There was no indication that suddenly it was going to be criminalized. So yeah, in August, I was woken up about 7:10 by 16 balaclavaed, I have to call them thugs, when there were some uniformed police trailing behind, but what you see come into your house is plain clothes, you can see black vans, the top end of town is closed off, the locals are terrorized, because they don't know what's happening. They think it's some sort of gun raid. Some said they didn't know whether they should run away, duck, or film it. They actually didn't really know what it was. And they're in your house. They say they have a warrant, but they're not going to reveal it to you. So they're in your house before you have a chance, really, to know that you should actually be shutting your door at this point and demanding a warrant. They're in already. I mean, there isn't the time. And you're pushed against the wall. And my son was pushed up against the wall. My house was absolutely ransacked. They were very clever. You know, they filmed it looking as if it was okay. And then most of the damage was probably done after they turned the cameras off. They hid things in places. They looted. They took things. They didn't list items. My son was thrown out of the house. I mean, he's just in his boxer shorts. So, you know, he then rang his dad, who came to support him and obviously probably bring some clothes as well. And, you know, they tore the house apart. And in doing so, you know, my mother's ashes were scattered all over. I live, my bedroom's actually an attic room, so it's spread all over the attic. And we still haven't managed to recoup all of her remains. There's a quarter of her remains missing. And to have to use a dustpan and brush to sweep up your mother's remains, that's going to stay with me for a long time. That was quite hideous. The fact that, you know, they didn't really care how much damage they caused. I mean, clothes, underwear, everything pulled out everywhere. And then they made some attempt to shove things back in the wrong drawer or the wrong wardrobe. And then, of course, as soon as they left, everything fell out on the floor anyway. So it's an absolute hideous mess. But items like my passport, these things weren't listed on, these are the items we've taken from your house list. So when they asked my son to sign that everything was in order, he just wanted them to go. They'd been there for hours. I think this was like 5 o'clock. He just wanted them to go. My son doesn't really know where my passport is, or where I've kept cash, or where some of my, you know, jewelry is. He doesn't know really what's missing. And why would he? Because he doesn't live here. He's just a guest. So, yeah, he signed it mainly to get rid of them. But because he signed the form, it is now very difficult to actually try and get any of these items back. I'm certainly not going to get my electronic devices back. They took other people's devices as well. They weren't all mine. And then wanted PIN numbers for devices that I don't own. So they took an awful lot of stuff, probably about £7,000 worth of equipment, if you add the mics and the headphones and you know, charger cables. And in fact, all of the cables, I've got lights on the stairs. Why do you need those cables? They're like one of those old fittings that you can never buy the cables for anymore. So it's just very malicious that like little items were taken, which kind of disabled the house from working properly. Bank cards missing, cash was taken, you know, everything that really decimated the house. And I don't know if they know what they were looking for. I think they were just looking for anything that they could pin on me. So there was this randomness about it. I don't, you know, they didn't find anything really. What they wanted was the devices. So they probably didn't need to destroy the house in the process. And it took us 7 days to put the house back together again, which is a long time. So,
well, I mean, what you've had to face is absolutely astounding and disgraceful and just so needless. And also, it's, as you said, it's sort of malicious and gratuitous, even the extent to which they have, you know, in the course of conducting this raid, damaged your house and, as you say, you know, scattered your mother's ashes. And it's really, really appalling. And also the effect, of course, then on, you know, someone like your son, completely, not that you're not innocent, but, you know, a completely sort of a third party to the whole situation, has been caught up in it, and absolutely no regard for him or his welfare. So it's just absolutely appalling. But of course, you know, you're one of many others who have been targeted. Perhaps the others haven't been targeted in quite the horrific way that you were, but we've seen Asa Winstanley, Richard Medhurst, Kit Clarenberg, others targeted. And that's just when we're talking about journalists, but we've also seen increasing crackdowns against activists, protesters, commentators, using brutal policing methods like you just outlined, and also quite intimidatory prosecutions. I mean, the situation is becoming quite severe now, isn't it?
It is, and what it is terrorism. It's terrorism against civilians, activists, reporters, doctors, teachers. And the elderly holding up placards. And I think there's been over 2,000 people arrested, and some of them very brutally. And every home raid has been a little bit different. It's like you'd almost think that there wasn't a pattern. I think that there is a pattern because there isn't a pattern. I think they're pushing out the boundaries. They're finding out how far they can go, who's going to take them to court, whether anybody's going to make an official complaint. You know, they're sort of testing the waters. So every home raid and every arrest has been a bit different. I've heard stories of an elderly woman left out in the snow in her nightgown for hours in bare feet while they searched her house and didn't allow her back in. So no compassion or even police protocol for, you know, taking people's age or their ability into account. So we've seen very young people being arrested very violently. So this almost is very close to sort of child abuse when somebody very, very young, by 30 and 40-year-old police officers who are balaclavaed in much the same way, treating people with utter brutality. It's very, very close. And so there is no... what is done with total disregard for age, gender, ability... and celebrity status, if you like, it doesn't really matter. So that it's an act of terrorism against us as civilians, against activists. And it's done, this is the irony, it's done in the name of countering terror, of anti-terror. It's done in the name of combating crime. And certainly isn't combating crime, arresting people that are innocent and have never committed any crimes. So, you know, when you're arresting an elderly person for holding up a placard, it's completely and utterly needless. And I think it is. It's British state terror. But they're using these anti-terror laws to commit this terrorism. And that is the irony of it, is these aren't terrorists. And these aren't people that would probably ever be, you know, ever do anything wrong. Or they're very law-abiding citizens, if you like. So... You know, if they were actually going after people that were making threats, you know, threats of life against other people, then that would be one thing. But these are just ordinary folk, or they're ordinary students who've never been arrested before, or they're teachers, parents. You know, how long before they start arresting young children? Well, they probably are under prevent. So, you know, it is terrorism, and they are using the anti-terror laws to commit their acts of terrorism. The irony is just astonishing, really.
Well, I mean, I wanted to actually consider this in a bit more detail, as you say, this sort of weaponization of anti-terror laws. I actually got into a discussion in some detail with a previous guest of mine who's quite well known, the barrister Frank McGuinness. Obviously, you're someone who's had this direct experience of these laws, which many would argue, and I certainly would argue, have been weaponized against you and others. You know, the whole modern concept of so-called terrorism, I think, has always been very problematic. But it seems to be the case now that terrorism, more blatantly than ever, just means behavior that the state doesn't like. And I think that has really increased, in particular, over the last sort of year or two. But surely that can't be sustainable. I mean, would you say that British society is going to reach breaking point over this? And how far do you think the government can really go in terms of continuously expanding this notion of terrorism and applying it against ordinary people?
I don't know how far it will go. And I don't know what the intention of it. I know that there is, well, when you're talking with young people, you know, people who say, oh, I'd never ring 999 anymore. I'd ring for a taxi to come and help me, but I'd never ring the police. I boycott Crime Stoppers. I don't have anything to do with the police any longer. Even very conservative, if you like, people that have been burgled, they've lost an awful lot of money. They own large properties. And the police have turned up sort of 4 weeks after the 999 call. And so we can't be bothered. Just go through your insurance. So what concerns me, I guess, And I know that nobody likes Douglas Murray, and I do get that, but he did. He was the one that did a bit of research and found out that the police hadn't actually solved any crime or burglary crime in the north for over a year. And it's purely because what they're doing is arresting people who aren't criminals. They're arresting people for voicing their opinion about the Israeli genocide. Anyone that supports Palestine, anyone that supports Gaza, anyone that knows anybody in Palestine or anybody reporting the news or, you know, who's got a public platform, they now are the ones who are criminalized. So on meeting a burglar in a pub a few months back, he actually said, "It's my most lucrative time. I can now burgle houses and the police don't give a damn." Now, there's a truth in that. They don't have time for crime any longer, but what they do have time for is protecting the Israeli state and protecting the Israeli genocide and protecting the government's very deep-rooted complicity in the genocide. So that's all they're working for now. They're just working to protect the Israeli regime. So everything else now, like I say, you make a 999 call. It'll take them 4 weeks to arrive, certainly in our area. And then if you're lucky, you'll get a text message saying, sorry, you've been a victim of crime. Then you'll never hear anything ever again. So I don't actually know where the police think that they're going on this. They're certainly turning the hearts and minds of people that have probably been quite supportive of the police away. They're stopping, young children don't want to ring 99 anymore. Parents aren't telling the kids to ring 99 in case the kids get taken away. There's this sort of fear, terror, that the police now are no longer working for us, but they're working for the Israeli regime. And they're doing it through the government, the British government, which is so tightly melted in to the regime that they're facilitating the genocide. They're selling them weapons. We're even hosting the Israeli weapons factories. We are trading like never before. Yeah, they made that 30%. They cut out 30% of the arms that they were sending to over to Israel, but it's probably a few wires and a few soundboards and a few things like this. But the majority of the drones are made here, the majority of the fleet. We're still making helicopter parts, Merkava tank, air conditioning parts. We're still trading with the Israelis to make sure that this genocide can continue. We're still sending them weapons. So, we've got to a stage where our government's no longer working for us. The police aren't working for us. I'm concerned that the judicial system is not working for us as well. I don't know what will happen with these 2,000 people. Will they just acquit them? Will they drop the charges? Will they continue to harass them? Will there be more home raids? This is fascism. And it's crept into our lives without us really noticing, to the point now where, you know, you have to lock your door every time you go out. You have to have a double lock on your door now when you go out. You know, you have to hide your devices. You have to turn things off. You have to make sure your PIN numbers are changed. You have to make sure everything is encrypted. It's like we've become paranoid of people that used to once serve us or used to once protect the communities. They no longer do that. They're becoming our enemies. And I don't know where that leads. I don't know what the pushback will be, but there will be one. There will be one.
Well, thank you very much for that, Sarah. I'm afraid that we have run out of time for part one of the programme, so we're going to have to pause our conversation there. But we'll be back with part two of Attrition before too long. See you next time.
true friend. To strengthen our hearts could never be rival. Broken walls could be built up again. And if you believe, the angels will guide you. Together it will give you strength. Heart of a Muslim.
Welcome, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start this hour's lineup with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. After that, we have Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions about children and adolescents and their upbringing. Israel Watch will follow next. The program aims to examine and criticize reports and analysis by Israeli media on current events and issues in West Asia region. And the Ocean of Dua is our final program this hour. The program gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. Stay with us for the next hour.
Iqara. بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
ودعوتك ربي بقرآن جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفران يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآن.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Mahdi. Thank you for having me, and assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program.
Thank
it's a pleasure to be
us.
With you.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. First, Brother Muhammad is going to talk about the music or the musical miracle of the Noble Quran. Then we all are going to listen to a recitation by a famous reciter of the Noble Quran. And at the end, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation from different aspects. Stay tuned. Well, in the first part of today's program, we are going to talk about the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. Up to now, we have talked about different aspects of the music of the Noble Quran, such as the intervals of the Noble Quran, the ease of understanding and remembering of the Noble Quran due to its rhyme and rhythm and arrangement of the letters and words. We talked about the length of the verses of the Noble Quran, and some other aspects. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about a new subject.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, in the previous program, we also talked about how the Quran, you know, it penetrates the hearts. And those who have piety, when they listen to the verses of the Quran,
they are impressed.
Yeah, not just impressed, they become very humble. And like their heart breaks.
In Arabic we say khushu'.
Yeah. Kharru sujjadan wa bukiya. Even tears flow from their eyes when they listen. That's if a person is very pious, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Or he has a very tender heart, that's what would happen. And this shows that person is very God-wary and has a very good heart.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala include us among those groups of people.
Yes. Just a thing I want to add to this from our previous discussion is that the Quran was and is so beautiful that even the stubborn Arabs, they also acknowledged the beauty of the Quran. They appreciated the eloquence of the Quran. A person by the name of Walid ibn Mughayra, he himself was like a person who knew a lot about literature, Arabic literature. He was a poet. He knew a lot about the eloquence of the Arabic language and the elements of the eloquence of Arabic. When he heard the verses of the Quran, he said, this is not the words of a human being. What did he say? He didn't say that this is the word of God. He said, فَغَالَ إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا سِحْرٌ يُؤْثَرْ. This is a kind of magic that is extremely effective. So even those who did not believe and were not willing to believe in Allah, they acknowledged that this Quran is, you know, is not something that a human being can bring.
Yes.
So,
subhanAllah.
A lot of people among Christians and Jews and non-Muslims, they say that Prophet Muhammad, he got the Quran, he derived the Quran from their books, from the Gospel, from the Bible, from the Torah, from the Old Testament, Book of Genesis, and all that doesn't make sense.
Well, Prophet Muhammad was illiterate,
illiterate. And how could he memorize all the things that they said? And also, the things that the Quran says is totally different from what those books say.
It's more complete.
They are incomplete. The Quran is perfect. وَلَوْ كَانَ مِنْ عِنْدِ غَيْرِ اللَّهِ لَوَجَدُوا فِيهِ اِخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. If it wasn't from Allah, you would see a lot of discrepancy